From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up on today's program, Vanuatu is in the early stages of cleanup. After a cyclone slammed across the island nation, we have more on Daybreak Asia in just a moment. China is busy building reefs and small islands in the disputed South China Sea, but they're not the only ones as Michael Lippin explores an Asia political scene. A push is underway to reduce the number of wrongful convictions in China. Sarah Williams deliberates on China Focus. Ira Melman steps off the bus and into the American Cafe as mass transit becomes increasingly important for city residents. World's disputes could be solved simply by having meals together. We break bread with David Byrd on today's Now. The Earth's ionosphere and GPS systems collide. That's coming up on Science World Express. Sports and business, too, on VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asian news and events for Monday, March 16th. Hi and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, as emergency assistance begins to arrive in cyclone-devastated Vanuatu, an international conference on disaster risk education considered actions to assist threatened Pacific Island nations in warding off future disasters. As Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok, the conference in Japan is pressing for greater global attention to issues of development and climate change.
The Asia-Pacific community Sunday responded with Office of Emergency Assistance and Medical Aid to storm-devastated Vanuatu, an archipelago of over 80 islands in the South Pacific, which bore the full force of Tropical Cyclone Pan. Fears are held of a rising death toll as aid workers attempt to reach communities isolated by the storm. In recent reports, the United Nations says Vanuatu, 1,750 kilometres northwest of Australia, is most at risk for national disasters ahead of Tonga in the Philippines. Vanuatu's president, Baldwin Lonsdale, speaking at the UN Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction in Sendai, Japan, called on the global community for aid for his stricken country.
I stand to appeal on behalf of the government and people of Vanuatu to the global community to give a lending hand in responding to these very current calamities that have struck us.
Australia and New Zealand said they are preparing emergency aid, with Australia providing an initial nearly $4 million, along with humanitarian supplies and shelters, as well as medical, search and rescue experts. The cyclone, with winds reaching over 300 kilometres per hour, is considered one of the most powerful and devastating to have hit the Pacific region. The tragedy coincided with the UN conference in Japan, itself hit by a 2011 earthquake and tsunami that claimed over 15,000 lives with an economic cost of $235 billion. The UN's Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, ESCAP, has already called on regional satellite-possessing countries such as India, China, South Korea and Japan to provide data and high-resolution images of Vanuatu to assist in relief efforts. A recent UN report put the economic losses from disasters over the past 45 years in the Asia-Pacific region at $1.5 trillion, with more than 2 million lives lost. The annual cost of damaged commercial and residential buildings from disasters globally is more than $300 billion. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Authorities in Pakistan say two suicide bombings outside Christian churches in the eastern city of Lahore have killed at least 15 people and wounded more than 70 others. A militant gang allied to the outlawed Pakistani Taliban has claimed responsibility. Ayaz Ghul gives details from Islamabad.
The bombings minutes apart targeted a Catholic and a Protestant church in a majority Christian suburb, Yuhanabad, where thousands of people had gathered for Sunday services. Hospital officials say many of those wounded in the attack are in critical condition. A senior Lahore police officer, Haider Ashraf, says two gunmen wearing suicide vests tried to shoot their way into the worship places.
The suicide bombers tried to enter inside the building, but then they blew into outside the churches because they were stopped by the concerned police people.
He said one police officer was killed and several others sustained injuries while successfully preventing the bombers from entering the prayer halls and limiting the damage. An eyewitness spoke to reporters shortly after the attack, saying she was buying things for her two sons who were inside the church when the attack occurred.
पहले फायरिंग हुई है फिर धमाका हुआ है मेरे सामने हुआ मेरे सामने गेट में धमाका हुआ है
She says there were gunshots first and then there was an explosion in front of the church gate. She said she has found one of her sons but the other was still missing. With nearly 1 million people, the Johannabad area has one of Pakistan's largest Christian communities. Witnesses said enraged residents of Johannabad lynched two men they suspected of involvement. The church bombings outraged other Christians who took to the streets in Lahore and other Pakistani cities to protest what they said was the authorities' failure to protect them. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The film India's Daughter, about the brutal rape and murder of 23-year-old Jyoti Singh in Delhi in 2012, has had its U.S. premiere in New York. India has banned the documentary, which details how five men and one juvenile gang raped the medical student on a bus and left her for dead after she left a movie theater with a male friend. Millions have watched the film online, and it is being broadcast across the world. Henry Ridgewell has more.
India's Daughter centers on an interview in jail with Mukesh Singh, one of the men convicted of the gang rape and murder. Questioned about the rape, Singh tells his interviewers that it takes two hands to clap. A decent girl won't roam around at 9 o'clock at night. He goes on to say that had the victim not fought back, the men would have dropped her off after doing it and only hit the young man she was with. The documentary has caused an uproar across India. The government has banned the film, labeling it a conspiracy to defame India. Protesters Sunday in Uttar Pradesh in northern India supported the ban. India's Daughter had its US premiere Monday night in New York. Among the stars expressing support was actress Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country in the world. There is not a single country in 2015 that is free of sexual violence against women. And hence this is a very important cause for me to take on.
The film's director, British filmmaker Leslie Udwin, says the attitude of the convicted rapist in the documentary runs through Indian society.
I got an insight and an understanding into the way he views women. And that is what is extremely shocking. And it's not just he who thinks that. It's a societal problem.
Critics say the film gives a platform to the murderers. The incident prompted nationwide protests in 2012. Since then, India has tightened its laws on rape, but Christina Zampas of Amnesty International says in reality, little has changed on the ground.
And it's important that India pass laws that are effective, that they implement those laws, that they train police to be gender sensitive, so that women, when they do report a rape, are treated sensitively and are given the care that they need, and that women actually participate in the development of laws.
Producers say the release of the film is the first step in a worldwide campaign against gender inequality and sexual violence against women and girls. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. At voanews.com, you'll find longer versions of these stories, plus other news of the day from the region. And be sure not to miss a Daybreak Asia. Subscribe to our free podcast.
Every day, VOA offers you a wide variety of stories, what's happening in the world, and you offer us your thoughts and opinions on those very stories. We welcome your feedback and ideas, like this one on our website at voanews.com. Russia on Friday rejected U.S. concerns about its use of a former American base in Vietnam for the refueling of Russian bomber flights around U.S. territory in the Pacific, disarming recent U.S. statements as puzzling and strange. John writes, if the Russians will support Vietnam against China, it means the United States does not need to. I'd say just leaning back and letting them do the work sounds like the most sensible approach. Hung Man from Vietnam says, if the U.S. really wants to improve the relations with Vietnam, it must bear in mind it should not interfere with Vietnam's relations and with other countries, including Russia. You are our former enemy, and Russia is our best friend and ally. Mark Heafy from France writes, Russia may be the best friend and ally of Vietnam, but Russia will not support you against China assertiveness. USA and its allies, Japan, Philippines, Australia, South Korea, does. That's a well-known truth for analysts in the region. Any different opinions on one story? You can find all of those on our website at voanews.com. And you can also write your own as well. We'd love to see them. Authorities in Pakistan said two suicide bombings outside Christian churches in the eastern city of Lahore killed 15 people, wounding more than 70 others. Anonymous wrote to us and says, it seems to me that the Christian minority live in Muslim countries suffer a nightmare. There's no help from the government, and the Muslim countries have no intention to protect them. The action of these countries is for pain and suffering of poor Christians when they live in a barbaric country. Well, that's one man's opinion. Write us. Give us yours. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. We're glad to have you with us today. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'd also like to have some of your photos from the recent Lunar New Year celebrations. They lasted a long time, about a month, and there were lots of different festivities going on in the region, and I'm sure lots of great opportunities for you to take pictures. We'd like to see yours. We're going to take the one that we think's the best and put it right at the top of our VOA Asia Facebook page.
It's time for the Asian political scene on VOA Global. I'm Michael Lippin. New satellite imagery showing China's rapid development of artificial islands in the disputed waters of the South China Sea has raised alarm in the region. The images published last month by defense intelligence company IHS Jane's show that the islands emerged from several reefs controlled by Beijing in the Spratly Island chain. IHS Jane's says that in the past 2 years, China appears to have been developing those reefs into military installations, ignoring rival sovereignty claims to those areas. In recent days, Philippine lawmakers have expressed concern that Manila is losing territory as a result of the Chinese construction. But other governments have been engaging in similar work in recent years, with those of Vietnam and Taiwan as prime examples. James Hardy is the Asia-Pacific editor at IHS Jane's Defense Weekly. I recently asked him how the construction efforts of the other governments contrast with China's.
The biggest difference between the two is that if you look at what the Chinese have been doing, the Chinese have been building basically where there didn't used to be an island. So they've been reclaiming land and basically destroying the underlying reef, dredging it, and turning that into kind of the basis for these new islands that they then reinforce with concrete. Whereas the other countries, Vietnam, Taiwan, and also Malaysia is another example, they've been doing it over the past few years, but it's been a kind of piecemeal effort. It hasn't been so concerted, hasn't been so orchestrated, and there doesn't seem to be a grand strategy involved. So I think that's one of the key things. That said, I mean, Vietnam, really, if you look imagery at Southwest Cape, it was in 2005, 2007, there was nothing there, and really it was kind of a bare kind of island covered in scrub. And now, if we look at it, it's quite a significant structure. It's got quite a lot of new developments there. You've got a load of defensive positions. You've got this harbour that I talk about, but that's been over 3 or 4 years, so much more gradual. Obviously, these countries don't tend to have the resources that China has, so that might be one explanation.
Well, I was just going to ask you why you think that the construction reclamation work by these other countries has been relatively happenstance and not perhaps as concerted as China. Do you think there's any particular reason, or could it be a variety of factors?
I think it's a variety of factors. I mean, one is that, you know, everyone involved did sign a declaration in 2002. You have the ASEAN declaration, which was signed between the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and China in 2002, under which everyone agreed that they wouldn't do anything provocative in the Spratly Islands or in the South China Sea generally. That said, if you look at what Vietnam then went to do with Southwest K, I mean, that could be viewed as provocative, but it was one or two installations which they've kind of upgraded, whereas what we see with China is a lot more than a minor upgrade. I mean, we're talking about creation of new land masses. Now, why has this happened? I mean, partly I think ASEAN and that declaration of 2002 did serve a purpose in the sense that it did stop people or countries from maybe escalating or going all out in a way that they otherwise would have done. That we would have seen kind of a upgrading, kind of not an arms race, but a capabilities race in the South China Sea if that hadn't have been signed. What's happened now is that, I mean, China's pretty much torn up that document with the activities done in the last 18 months. And really now it's just kind of going hell for leather, just trying to get this chain of installations up as quickly as possible. And really, I think everyone else is just kind of standing there and watching and seeing what the effect of this will be on the balance of power in this part of the world, and what China's going to actually do with these installations once they're fully up and running.
That was James Hardy of IHS Jane's Defense Weekly speaking from London. In next week's program, he'll explain what China's neighbors have been doing to counter its island-building efforts in the Spratlys. Hope you'll join us then. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. China's top judge is vowing to reduce the number of wrongful convictions issued by the country's judicial system, which critics accused of corruption and a reliance on forced confessions. Zhou Chong, the Chief Justice of China's Supreme People's Court, spoke last week at an annual parliamentary session. He said, with regard to miscarriages of justice, we deeply reprove ourselves and demand that courts at all levels draw profound lessons and further strengthen the effective prevention of unjust and false cases and timely correction mechanisms. Zhou said the SPC will take steps to prevent government officials from interfering in legal cases, a practice seen as commonplace in a court system controlled by the Communist Party. Carl Menzner is a professor at the Fordham University Law School in New York, and he specializes in Chinese law.
I think it's definitely a positive development, and I think it reflects a reformist tendency that's been notable within the Chinese court system, particularly the Supreme People's Court, since Zhou Chong assumed office in 2012, and a commitment that actually goes back for past several years regarding the issue of trying to address wrongful convictions in China.
Is it known how often do wrongful convictions occur?
Well, it's certainly known that it's a serious problem. I mean, when Zhou Chong spoke, I think he noted that last year Chinese courts were reviewing over like 1,300 instances of wrongful convictions. But there have been a spate of really high-profile wrongful conviction cases that have broken in the media over the past couple of years, where the person who was alleged to be dead turned out to be alive, even after the suspect had been jailed or in some cases killed. And those particular cases, the fact that there have been, blatant abuses of process going on within the system, I think those are some of the things that prompted the move towards, on the part of Zhou Chong, towards addressing, and others within the system.
Certainly a very famous case occurred in 1996. A teenager by the name of Hu Glit, from Inner Mongolia, he was convicted of rape and murder and then executed. And later on, authorities determined that he did not do it. And I believe an apology was made to Huglet's parents, but how terrible for them, this situation.
Absolutely. And I think that case was flagged both in Zhou Chong's work report to the National People's Congress, and I believe also the Supreme People's Procuratorate report to the National People's Congress. I think both of them mentioned specifically that case.
Apparently, the conviction rate in China is extremely high. I mean, apparently in 2013, it was something like 99.9%. Comparing China, say, to some other countries, I mean, is that typical?
That's a very, very, very high conviction. That's an extremely high conviction rate, and it does reflect series of institutional issues that are going on within the system, things ranging from limited legal representation on the part of defendants, pressure on police to crack cases in the form of targets for conviction targets that they're required to hit that are tied to their annual salaries or career promotion that puts strong pressure on line officer cops to break cases, extensive use of pretrial detention in some cases in the past, incidences of torture and forced confessions. And many of those things taken together create, of course, a system where you end up with extremely high conviction rates and also instances, as I mentioned, forced confessions. And that ties into some of these wrongful conviction issues that Chinese authorities are attempting to address now.
Do you think by any chance, perhaps social media, the fact that citizens can comment about cases like that, is perhaps making Chinese officials a bit more careful about some of these cases?
I certainly think that, you know, the fact that some of these cases break online, that puts pressure on Chinese authorities to address them. Of course, you know, the flip side of that is when you run into the censorship apparatus, that creates problems. But I do think that there's something going on right now with Chinese authorities themselves having flagged wrongful convictions as an area that they're sort of open to some limited degree of, you know, discussion in terms of addressing. I think that's also meant that there's a little more space on this particular area to discuss and raise issues.
Commentators on Sina Weibo express sympathy for the family of Huglet, the teenager who was wrongly convicted of murder and who was executed in 1996. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson with Asia Business News on the Voice of America. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang expressed determination Sunday to press ahead with reforms meant to reduce the Chinese government's role in the world's second largest economy in hopes of spurring growth, despite what he acknowledged would be pain for vested interests that benefit from regulation. Quotes, he says, "This is not nail clipping. This is like taking a knife to one's own flesh," he said at a news conference after the close of China's annual legislature in Beijing. He went on to say, "But however painful it might be, we are determined to keep going until our job is done." During his only news conference of the year, the premier repeated pledges to reduce requirements for government approval of new businesses. He said the number of private businesses being set up has doubled, following efforts already underway to simplify the process of registering new enterprises. Car makers, including Volkswagen, Nissan, and Daimler, were scrambling late Sunday after China's annual Consumer Rights Day TV show said the firms oversold repairs and spare parts to drivers. According to Reuters, the annual 3.15 investigative special on China's central television, CCTV, which is similar to the CBS network's 60 Minutes here in the United States, also criticized Jaguar, Land Rover for gearbox problems in some cars. China is the world's top auto market, and media criticism can dent reputations and drag on sales. iPhone maker Apple made a rare apology in 2013 after criticism on the show of its after-sales service. German carmaker Volkswagen, a target 2 years ago, was further criticized in an article before the show for handling recalls. That's a look at Asia Business News on the Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On March 16, 597 BC, a Babylonian force under the leadership of King Nebuchadnezzar II captured the Jewish capital city of Jerusalem following a siege. In 1190, a number of Jews in York, England were massacred. Others committed suicide rather than submit to forced baptism. In 1751, U.S. President James Madison was born. Madison is known as the father of the U.S. Constitution. In 1802, the U.S. Congress founded the U.S. Military Academy, the country's first military school, for the purpose of educating and training young men in the theory and practice of military science. Located in West Point, New York, the U.S. Military Academy is simply known as West Point. On this day in 1850, The Scarlet Letter, Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel about spiritual and moral issues set in 17th century America, was first published. An instant bestseller, the novel remains a classic in American literature. In 1916, two regiments under the command of John J. Pershing crossed the U.S.-Mexico border to join the hunt for the notorious Mexican border raider, Pancho Villa. On this day in 1926, Robert H. Goddard successfully launched the world's first liquid fuel rocket. In 1935, German dictator Adolf Hitler ordered the rearmament of his country in violation of the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I. In 1968, during the Vietnam War, a company of American soldiers on a search and destroy mission killed hundreds of unarmed civilians in what has come to be known as the My Lai Massacre. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Yeah.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, aid agencies start to get a picture of the devastation in Vanuatu from a powerful cyclone. The top U.S. diplomat gives his latest assessment of prospects for a nuclear deal with Iran. And China's premier responds to domestic criticism about the environmental costs of pollution. I'm Michael Lippin. Relief supplies have begun flowing into Vanuatu after a powerful tropical cyclone slammed into the South Pacific island nation late Friday and Saturday. Cyclone Pam battered Vanuatu with winds of 300 kilometers per hour, tearing off rooftops, downing power lines, and toppling trees. Authorities have confirmed at least 8 deaths and more than 20 injuries from the storm. But the death toll is expected to rise as rescuers reach the more remote islands in the archipelago. Australia's News Corp says the Red Cross has reported that a pilot managed to fly over 2 of those remote islands on Sunday. The Red Cross quoted the pilot as saying entire communities were flattened by the cyclone. But it also said the pilot was able to land his plane on one of the islands. Aid worker Charlie Damon with relief agency CARE said her organization was able to drive around Vanuatu's capital, Port Vila, on Sunday to check on evacuation centers. But she said CARE still faces a daunting task in the recovery effort.
I cannot imagine how long it's going to take to work in Port Vila alone. So we're talking, you know, months to maybe a year, maybe even longer, to be able to get this country, to help this country recover and to help the people of Vanuatu recover to this devastating event.
Australia is responding to Vanuatu's appeals for help, providing $5 million for relief agencies and humanitarian assistance. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the obstacles to a nuclear deal between Iran and major world powers are more political than technical. Kerry was speaking to U.S. television network CBS on Sunday ahead of a trip to Switzerland this week to continue negotiations with Iran aimed at overcoming those obstacles. VOA's Michael Bowman has more.
Years of negotiations with Iran could hinge on the next 2 weeks. Speaking in Egypt, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry sounded impatient for a resolution one way or another.
We've been at this for over 2 years now, and Iran has said its program is peaceful. If it's peaceful, let's get it done. And my hope is that in the next days that will be possible.
Negotiations are resuming in Geneva 1 week after 47 Republican senators sent an open letter to Iran's leaders warning any agreement reached could be undone by a future U.S. president or derailed by an act of Congress. The Obama administration has strenuously and repeatedly denounced the missive, and Iran has responded with ridicule. But the letter's author, Senator Tom Cotton, says he has no regrets.
In our constitutional system, while the president negotiates deals, Congress has to approve them for them to be lasting and binding. Iran's leaders needed to hear the message loud and clear. I can tell you they are not hearing that message from Geneva.
Majorities in both houses of Congress have voiced support for enacting tougher sanctions on Iran that would take effect if talks fail, and for an up or down congressional vote on any deal that is reached. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
As Syria enters a 5th year of civil war, Secretary of State Kerry says the United States will have to reach a deal with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to enable a political settlement of the conflict. In the same interview with CBS, Kerry said, "We have to negotiate with Mr. Assad." The United States previously has demanded that the Syrian president step down for leading a brutal crackdown against an opposition uprising that escalated into the civil war. Kerry did not specify what the terms of a potential deal with Mr. Assad could include. A U.S.-backed attempt by the United Nations to mediate a truce between the Syrian government and the opposition failed in 2014. Pakistani authorities say 2 suicide bombings outside Christian churches in the city of Lahore have killed at least 15 people. Another 70 were wounded, many critically. Authorities said 2 gunmen tried to shoot their way into the churches during services on Sunday in the majority Christian suburb of Johannesburg. When security guards stopped them in the gates, the attackers detonated the explosives. Officials said a militant group allied to the Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the attacks. China's Premier Li Keqiang says the Chinese government is still falling short of meeting public expectations about environmental pollution. A documentary about air pollution that recently went viral online in China, called Under the Dome, highlighted that sentiment before it was blocked by authorities. But one day after the Chinese National People's Congress opened, it was ordered to be taken offline, despite more than 200 million people already watching it. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
The documentary by former state-run television reporter Cai Jing looks at the health impacts of China's massive smog problem, the challenges environmental authorities face in enforcing the law, and how state-run enterprises, particularly energy companies, are part of the problem. During a news conference Sunday at the end of the annual legislative meetings, Chinese Prime Minister Li Keqiang was asked what he made of claims in the film about big oil companies and whether they are an obstacle to environmental enforcement. Without mentioning the film, Mr. Li said tackling environmental pollution, especially smog, is a concern that is high on all people's minds. He said the government is determined to tackle the problem and has taken steps to bring that about. But he added the effort has fallen short of the public's expectations. The general message of the documentary appears to dovetail nicely with efforts authorities are making to address the problem. But it is not clear why it was blocked or the issue not mentioned publicly until the final news conference. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
The Reuters news agency says more than 1 million Brazilians marched across the country on Sunday to protest a sluggish economy, rising prices and corruption, and to call for the impeachment of leftist president Dilma Rousseff. The marches across the continent-sized country come as Brazil struggles to overcome economic and political malaise and struggles to pick up the pieces of a boom that crumbled once Rousseff took office in 2011. And here in the U.S., police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri, have made an arrest in connection with last week's shooting of two police officers during a protest outside police headquarters. The shootings happened early Thursday morning, just hours after the city's police chief resigned in response to a U.S. Justice Department report that accused his police team of racially biased practices against black residents. A St. Louis prosecutor said the 20-year-old suspected gunman, Jeffrey Williams, told authorities he was firing at someone with whom he was in a dispute, not at the police officers. That's it for International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
This is Asia Business News on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. A real estate investment trust that is considering getting out of the snow business could be selling more than a dozen ski resorts from Maine to California that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. CNL Lifestyle Properties owns 16 resorts, including two in Maine, three in New Hampshire, and resorts in Vermont, Colorado, Utah, and California. If CNL sells them to all or one buyer, industry officials said it would be the largest single ski resort transaction in the history of the sport, although skiers might not notice the sale at all. CNL will evaluate options for its remaining properties, including ski resorts, theme parks, and marinas in the near future, according to its senior managing director. While the Keystone Pipeline Project awaits a final decision from Congress, lesser-known developments that have quietly added more than 11,600 miles or over 18,000 kilometers of pipeline to the nation's domestic oil network, and that has increased by almost a quarter in the last decade. The work dwarfs the proposed Keystone Pipeline Project. About 3.3 million barrels per day of capacity have been added since 2012 alone. That's five times more oil than the Canada to Texas Keystone Line could carry if it is ever built. The U.S. government is appealing to a federal court ruling that reduced the potential penalty that BP must pay for the 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill by almost $4 billion. Reuters reports the appeal was filed Friday in U.S. District Court in New Orleans. It challenges a January decision by U.S. District Court Judge Carl Barbier that set the size of the spill at 3.19 million barrels. The appeal did not detail what aspects of the ruling were being challenged. To look at business news. A conservation group attached a small video camera to the back of an eagle, which then took off from the top of Dubai's Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest tower. The eagle flew about 830 meters, offering some breathtaking views of the commercial capital of the United Arab Emirates. And people down on the ground could see it live as it was being transmitted. It included his roller coaster dive into a man's arm on the ground.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. A record number of Americans are moving into cities and, at the same time, curbing their driving habits. No better example than New York City. VOA's Bernard Chessman visits the cafe with the story.
3.4 billion riders on New York City subways and buses a year. This amazing number equals one-third of all mass transit trips in the United States. Ridership is at its highest in almost 60 years in almost every American city. A commuter advocacy group, Straphangers Campaign, attributes it to younger Americans, says Gene Rushinoff.
Millennials, those people born around the turn of this past century, are much less car-oriented.
In addition to millennials, many people believe public transit is economical and eco-friendly. In 2012, across America, people took 10.7 billion trips. New York is not standing still, as passenger demand requires several major expansion projects. A new $4.5 billion subway line on New York's 2nd Avenue will take an overload of passengers off of other subway lines. Its first phase completion is scheduled in 2016. And probably the most controversial and costly project is a $7 billion tunnel connection from Long Island into Manhattan's Grand Central Terminal. Trains from there will have access to New York's Midtown Business District. Andrew Albert, a board member of the Metropolitan Transit Authority, says there are many other reasons the public is riding in increasing numbers.
The system has gotten a lot more dependable. We have new cars. We have countdown clocks to tell you when the next trains are coming. We have expanded facilities in places.
New York's 24-hour, 7-day-a-week transit system costs $1.5 billion a year to maintain. It is one of the world's oldest, with its first subway line having opened in 1904. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, New York.
We go from the most populous city in the United States, New York, to one of its least populated, a farming community in western Kansas. Young people have been leaving areas like this as the business of the area, agriculture, dries up along with a diminishing supply of what is the lifeblood of farming, water. Kane Farabaugh visited Colby, Kansas.
Mitchell Ballman's farm outside Hoxie, Kansas is about as rural as you can get.
Kind of out here by ourselves, you know, not a lot of populace.
And not a lot of rain due to a prolonged drought.
We were the eternal optimist of farmers out here in western Kansas, so we always think it's going to get better.
Ballman farms land that has been in his family for four generations. His father was born during the infamous Dust Bowl in the 1930s, when the farmland dried out, dusted up, and drove people away. But what makes the current drought different from the Dust Bowl at the Ballman family farm is the Ogallala Aquifer. Out in the heart of his wheat fields, an industrial pump draws water out of a well tapped into the massive underground aquifer. The water reaches an above-ground pivot system that slowly moves in a circular pattern over the planted crops. Ballman says it is a major improvement over the old pipe systems that used to flood the farmland.
10 years ago, we might have averaged 700 to 800 gallon per minute wells. Today, we're probably averaging 400.
Ballman is proud of those figures. He is keenly aware that the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer could ultimately drive his family off the land.
I started realizing the importance of water when I realized that my boys and everybody else's kids want to move back to these small towns. So to keep bringing the populace back to our small communities, we have to have the water.
Kane Farabaugh, VOA News,
Colby, Kansas.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Come on in every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Could sitting down around the dinner table help start a dialogue in some of the hottest conflict spots in the world? Well, that's the question. A new series starring award-winning journalist Mariana Van Zeller and acclaimed chef Michael Voltaggio looks to answer. The show, Breaking Borders, has Van Zeller and Voltaggio traveling to places notorious for civil war, ethnic conflict, and religious disputes. The 13-show season features stops in Belfast, Beirut, Sarajevo, Kashmir, Sri Lanka, and in the premiere episode, Israel's West Bank.
Every Saturday on Shabbat, conservative Jews tour the old town of Hebron, a city they believe they are entitled to because it's part of the Holy Land. Combat-ready soldiers are guarding them. The Palestinians who live here feel these weekly tours are an insult.
Van Zeller provides the historical context and the background. Voltaggio, a winner on the Top Chef show and the owner of the popular Los Angeles restaurant Inc., meets with local grocers and restaurateurs to prepare a meal for the guests. Van Zeller says the dinner table provides a unique venue for discussions to start that might not start in any other context.
Some of the most important decisions I've made in my life have been sitting down at a dinner table. It's a place where you go for sustenance, obviously, but it's also a place where you go to gather around and to talk about your life. And it's just a perfect place where people feel free to talk in a way that they don't otherwise.
Voltaggio is given freedom to devise the menu, and he has never been to these locations before, so he ends up relying on the locals to advise him on what to cook. Local liaisons get the participants to agree to come to the dinner. Voltaggio says that sometimes it works great, but other times people don't want to participate.
We actually meet each guest together leading up to the show, leading up to the dinner. We meet each guest together leading up to the dinner. And then, we have meals and things like that along the way as well. So we get to experience everything together, yeah. Mm-hmm. Including each individual person. And then the day of the dinner, she's preparing to basically be the moderator or make sure that everyone even sits down at the table together. I mean, it's her responsibility to get the guests to the table and keep them there. And it's sort of my responsibility to hopefully make the food taste good enough that they'll feel comfortable to sit down and talk with each other.
The guests discuss their personal views on their conflict, as in a dialogue between Israeli settler Yaakov Berg and Munther Fahmy, a Palestinian bookstore owner.
We need to live together, first of all. Second, we don't need to control the Palestinians.
So why do you do it?
Because we're forced to do that. But we don't want to do that. And wait a minute. And
why are
now,
you forced? Why are you forced?
Because if we will stay here, the Palestinians will kill us.
You know, you are really part of the biggest obstacle to peace in this part of the world is the illegal Israeli settlements and people who look like really nice to have dinner with. You are very, very more dangerous, I have to say to you in your face, than a terrorist.
Van Zeller and Voltaggio both said that shooting the show in conflict zones helped facilitate dialogue between groups of people who might never have talked to one another.
There have definitely been fights, but overall, again, at the end of every meal, people have been able to stand up and just be, you know, be happy that they came and that they were part of it.
The show premieres March 15th on the Travel Channel and runs for 13 weeks. You can learn more about Breaking Borders by logging on to www.travelchannel.com/breaking borders. So what do you think? Is dinner table diplomacy a good idea? Would you sit down to eat with someone that you regarded as an enemy? Do you think it would make a difference? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
In the eastern U.S. state of New Jersey, when people ask each other, "Where are you from?" they usually ask the question, "What exit are you from?" to figure out where they live. That's because they have the New Jersey Turnpike and several others that crisscross the state. Well, people who live there may be a little confused, at least for a while, in the Woodbridge area. They've renumbered a few of the exits, swapped a few numbers, and that's just going to be a little confusing for a while till they get used to it. Time for sports on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. You know, playing on your home course is usually an advantage, and it was for South African golfer George Coetzee, who has won the Shawnee Open. Mark Tompkins is there, and he has the final results.
George Coetzee is the Shawnee Open champion after a final round at 65 took him onto 14 under par and victory by a shot from fellow South African Jack Blau, who'd earlier posted an excellent clubhouse target of 13 under par after a final round 61, the lowest round of the week. Dean Burmester, Tjaart van der Vogt and Craig Lee were all in a tie for third on 9 under par, but this was all about Coetzee playing on his home course. The turning point came on the 17th when he picked up a birdie 3 to go to 14 under, and a steady par on the last. A cheers from the gallery saw him lift the trophy.
Playing the back nine, I always thought like 17, that's going to be the one. That's why I've got to make birdie on 17, so take a bit of pressure off the 18th and obviously give myself a cushion. But obviously I had to par all the other holes, but yeah, the chip on 17 is, I guess, I've hit that shot before.
He won it by a shot, finishing at 14 under par. George Coetzee wins the Shawnee Open by a shot from Jack Blau.
Mark Tompkins reporting. Back in 2001, Serena Williams was heckled by the crowd at Indian Wells, California, as she defeated Kim Clijsters of Belgium in the final to claim her second title, and she vowed that she would never play there again. But on Friday, in her first match back at Indian Wells since that day, Williams was welcomed with a standing ovation. "I didn't know what to expect," she said, after her second-round victory against Romania's Monica Niculescu, and that was pretty hard-fought, 7-5, 7-5, at the BNP Paribas Open at the Indian Wells Tennis Garden. "In the last couple of moments leading up to it, I was focused on warming up for the match," she said, "and I wasn't really prepared for that. I was overwhelmed by it." Well, good to see Serena Williams back at the event. India beat Ireland by 8 wickets at the Cricket World Cup Tuesday, remaining unbeaten after 5 matches to clinch its place at the top of Pool B, while stalling Ireland's celebrated push for a place in the tournament quarterfinals. Shakir Dhawan scored 100, Rohit Sharma hit 64 in a 174-run opening partnership, its best at a World Cup, as India chased down Ireland's 259 with 13.1 overs remaining. India will be staying at the top of the pool regardless of the outcome of its last group match against Zimbabwe. Ireland must now take at least 1 point from the last match of the pool round against Pakistan in Adelaide to have any chance of progressing to the knockout stages. And that's sports on VOA Global.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Researchers from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Canada's University of New Brunswick are conducting a joint research project to look for and study irregularities in the Earth's ionosphere that can interfere with the global positioning system. Dr. Richard Langley from the University of New Brunswick is a member of the research team. He tells us what he and his colleagues hope to learn from their study.
The ionosphere actually is a layer in the Earth's upper atmosphere, about 350 kilometers or so above the Earth's surface, where electrons exist as a result of solar radiation, primarily ultraviolet light coming from the sun. It hits the Earth's atmosphere, and the electrons are removed from their parent atoms and molecules so that they can exist more or less freely in a kind of a soup of electrons and ions. Now, the ionosphere is not the same everywhere. It varies both in location and over time. Usually, the ionosphere is well-behaved, but sometimes the ionosphere can get disturbed. This happens when the sun emits what's known as a coronal mass ejection of high-energy particles, and these eventually reach the Earth and through an interaction with the Earth's geomagnetic field and the Earth's atmosphere, we end up with a disturbed ionosphere. And so we can have then irregularities occurring in the ionosphere. Our recent results actually show that these irregularities are different in the different regions of the ionosphere. So in the polar regions, they seem to be different in size than in the auroral zone, which is the region where the auroras are most commonly seen. And they will be different again from mid-latitudes where a lot of us live. What we're basically seeing is changes in the density of electrons, that is, how many of these electrons exist in any one place. It's being able to measure, to monitor those irregularities, how big they are, where they occur, when they occur, will enable us to learn more about how the ionosphere actually works and how it relates to the radiation coming from the sun and the Earth's magnetic field. And when, for example, we get an outburst from the sun, how will the ionosphere respond? We can't yet predict very well what the response of the ionosphere will be, how the ionosphere will change, how it might, for example, disturb the reception of GPS signals. So we need to learn a lot more about the ionosphere. And our recent study, I think, helps a little bit in that regard.
What did you learn?
What we learned, and we learned this actually by using GPS signals themselves. You know, we can use GPS for determining where we are, for positioning, for navigation, for getting us from one place to another. We can use it for accurate timing. So these are all kind of conventional ways of using GPS signals. But the GPS satellites are much higher than the ionosphere. So the signals from the GPS satellites have to come down through the ionosphere to receivers on or near the Earth's surface. And they actually pick up information about the ionosphere. The ionosphere actually slows down the speed with which the radio signals travel, just a little bit. And that has an effect on determining positions using those GPS signals. Now, most of us don't see the effect of the ionosphere because it's fairly small compared to the positioning accuracies that we usually get. But there are high-precision users of GPS, such as surveyors, geodesists, other scientists, which are interested in getting the highest possible accuracies. And they have to contend with this effect of the ionosphere, and they try to correct for it. One easy way to do that is to use both of the frequencies that are transmitted by the GPS satellites. You can actually combine the two signals, or the measurements made on those two signals, and essentially remove the effect of the ionosphere. But those self-same signals and the same observations, if they're processed in a slightly different way, you can actually extract out the information about the ionosphere. So we can use GPS as a tool for studying the ionosphere and for looking at irregularities in the ionosphere.
That was Dr. Richard Langley at Canada's University of New Brunswick. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. Please visit us on the internet at voanews.com/science.
A couple of weeks ago, we told you about a small town in the Netherlands that was being terrorized from the air. Residents there, having problems with an aggressive eagle owl that terrorized their town. It swooped out of the sky, sunk its talons into their heads. The bird earned the name, nickname, Terror Owl. In Purmerend, it's about 20 kilometers north of Amsterdam, where it attacked some 50 people over the last year. Some of the bird's victims required hospital treatment to stitch up deep scratches. Residents took to walking the streets with umbrellas or wearing hats to ward off the aerial attacks. Well, the city obviously knew about this, understand the problem, and Purmerend Municipality announced that a falconer it hired has caught the bird on Friday. It says that the bird was in good health, and it is now awaiting a suitable new home, preferably where there are few people for it to attack. Meanwhile, in Alaska, a blind dog is helping its musher, Kelly Maxner, find the Iditarod finish line in western Alaska. It's a 5-year-old sled dog named Laura. It had cornea disease. It can't see, but his musher says that the dog runs really well in the pack with the others and really helps to pull the sled well. Congratulations. Our time is up here at VOA Global. We would like to congratulate our director, Tracy Carter, our engineers, Daryl Smith and Carl Starling, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope to join you right back here again tomorrow with another edition of VOA Global.